looks haunted. What could it be? It's the Babysitter's Club Mystery.
Welcome to Stuck in Stony Brook, a podcast about the Babysitter's Club. Today we're discussing Mystery 19, Christy and the Missing Fortune. I liked that it didn't have mystery in the title.
Me too. I was very grateful, like unreasonably grateful, that it didn't have mystery in the title. I really liked this one. Did you guys like this one?
Yeah.
Yeah. It was different.
Yeah. I felt like it was less like they were solving an actual mystery, like that an adult would call a mystery. It wasn't just like our college roommate used our house too. And it had stakes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The reappearance of Cokie Mason was weird.
Yeah. It was a little disappointing.
We didn't need that.
Yeah. And why didn't you use her better? I thought. But right. I mean, it was just to set up the punchline in the final paragraph, basically. But I was excited to see her at first. And then I felt like she was underutilized.
Yeah. She should have done something like more evil.
Mm. Or like been redeemed.
Ooh, look Either at Emily. Or. Look at Emily with the redemption arc for Cokie Mason. I like that idea.
I don't know if she was like not, I mean, I guess we're spoiling the plot here, but.
We're about to. It's fine. You can spoil it now instead of in 5 minutes.
If she was like not invested in the mystery just because she was like money hungry, but she was like, I don't know, envious that Christy was like developing a relationship with her grandmother or something. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like it could have been rendered in a way that made her either more evil or more sympathetic. And I would have enjoyed either.
Mm, yeah. I mean, I think this is the problem with like other people telling her story, right? Because it could have been that. We don't know.
Well, right.
You know, so we never really get inside Cokie's head. So we never really get to find out.
That's true.
Anyway, speaking of the plot, do you guys have your one sentence summaries?
I do.
Yeah.
Great. Anne, you want to go first?
Sure. Christy thinks she's going to gain wealth again without any effort of her own.
Nice.
Fair. Fair. Emily, how about you?
I just wanted to pose a question, which is that the babysitters solve like 25 micro mysteries in one book. There's so many mysteries that get rolled into one. And I was like, the threads are a little tenuous, but I don't know.
That's true. Unpack. I think that's why I liked it, because there were so many mysteries. It was like, oh, there's really mystery here. Yeah, fair. I went more global. Christy and the gang solve a mystery and save an arboretum. Mm.
Oh. Yeah, very descriptive.
It's true.
But I mean, really, does Christy need another $3 million or whatever with Watson in the picture? I find it a little bit outlandish. It's like... What?
In my notes, it just says Christy wants to be rich in quotes, like eye roll. Yeah.
I don't know. It's a little annoying.
I mean, if you're 13, do you think of your step parents' wealth as your own wealth?
No, but in every book, she's like, Watson's a real millionaire and we live in a mansion.
Right. So, all of that's true. But I think she's like independently minded. She's thinking about her future.
Oh, come on.
I just think any kid, regardless of how much money they have, likes the idea of a missing fortune.
I just feel like they could have given this mystery to a different babysitter.
Sure. Yeah.
The rich I mean,
they're all pretty rich, though, right? They live in this New England bedroom community, and like none of them are. I mean, maybe Mallory needs it the most just because of the sheer number of kids in the family and because Mr. Pike was laid off before. But like Jesse goes to this expensive ballet school in Stanford. And
yeah, but Christy's family is far and away the wealthiest.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah. So you're just saying any one of the other sitters would have been better.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I feel like, And also, there's always, you know, they live in the normal part of Stony Brook, and then Christy lives across town in the rich part.
Yeah, so. Fair enough. I just don't want to pretend that any of them are like wanting for anything.
Well, that would also be like poverty porn if it's like
it
the one poor family and she's like desperately seeking this fortune that doesn't exist.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I would hate that.
Anna Martin does that a little bit in this other series she did later called Main Street. There's like one poor character who lives on the outskirts of town. Yeah.
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 Well, we should probably back up and tell you about the members of the podcast. I'm Annie Chikawa, a freelance writer. I'm a mischievous pragmatist with a sweet tooth.
I'm Emily Crandall, a feminist scholar. I'm a total individual and I like health food.
And I'm Esme Schaller, an adolescent psychologist. I'm kind of bossy, but I have a big heart. If you want to learn more about us and how we know each other, check out our prologue episode. Also, rate and review us. It really helps people find the podcast. If you have any questions, comments, or commentary about anything BSC related, you can drop us a line at stuckinstonybrook@gmail.com. You can also support us on Patreon at patreon.com/stuckinstonybrook. And today we have a mailbag. I feel like we should have a little mini jingle for listener letters, but we don't have that. You want to just sing one right now, Anne?
Like you've got mail or something?
Sure. Yeah.
Do people even know what that is? I guess our listeners do.
Yes, they do. Go ahead.
You've got mail.
Oh, that was very good. Right tone. Perfect. Perfect. So we got this lovely letter from Amanda that I think is well-timed. She may not know why yet, but we recently did, speaking of Patreon, recently did a Patreon episode about the pilot of 90210. If you're interested to hear Emily's unfiltered first impressions, having not watched it previously, that's up now. Anne, why don't you read this letter from Amanda?
Okay. So Amanda writes, I'm getting caught up on back episodes and recently listened to Get Well Soon, Mallory. As a Canadian of the same generation as Anne and Esme, I was born in 1980, I resonated with the mono kissing disease reference from the iconic Degrassi Junior High episode Sealed with a Kiss. This show, Degrassi High, and schools out the Degrassi High movie were absolutely foundational in my younger years. The F-bomb in Schools Out that wasn't censored on CBC really left an impression with me and my peers. We still quote the line from the movie. Tackling important topics for its time like teen pregnancy and abortion, HIV, disability, intimate partner violence, interracial relationships, impaired driving and suicide, it really was a great show. While I can't convince my 17-year-old daughter to rewatch with me, many of the topics have seemed to hold up, minus the hair and clothes. My favorite factoid, I like to think it is true, is that Aaron Spelling developed Beverly Hills 90210 based on the original Degrassi series. I'm curious if the show made its way to you as teens in the U.S. before Degrassi, The Next Generation, became much more mainstream. I love your show. You all are the best.
Aw, thanks, Amanda.
So sweet. I only remember whatever Degrassi Drake was in.
Oh, no, that's much, much later.
Later.
Yeah.
Did you watch Degrassi Junior High, Anne, on PBS?
I did. But it was like, it was like a treat when I caught it.
Yes.
Because it was never on. And then sometimes it was on. I'd be like, oh, crap, it's on. And I'd be like really into it because there was Spike and then her little like alterna boyfriend who had wore like the fedora. I thought they were really cool.
The way you said it was a treat, I like viscerally, I can remember like you're like turning through the channels and then that it would be the end of the theme song. They're like, Degrassi Junior High. And I'd be like, oh my God, it's here. But it seemed like they always showed it at different times. Like you could never find it.
Yeah,
it was hard to get. It was like limited CBC distribution in the US. So it was on our public broadcasting channel, but not frequently. So we couldn't like get into the whole storyline. And I didn't know there was a movie. Did you know there's a movie?
No.
Yeah.
I do remember Spike was pregnant.
Mm.
You remember that? I thought that was, whoa, she has like crazy hair and she's pregnant.
Yeah.
That was
my thought. How did both those things happen?
I know.
Maybe we should watch the movie for Patreon.
Yeah. That would be fun. I'm really interested in that.
And there's this, do you know that ska band, Skink and Pickle?
Sure.
Have you heard of them? They have a song called I'm in Love with a Girl Named Spike, which is about
Nice.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah, it was a good show. I am jealous of you knowing that having it be a consistent part of your adolescence, Amanda, because I think that would have been good for all of us American teenagers, but we just didn't have it. It was good. I felt the other show like that I felt like just showed up occasionally was Voyage of the Mimi. Like I felt like I wanted to watch that more. Yeah, I didn't know that was Ben Affleck until years and years and years later, obviously. But that was another one that I felt like I couldn't plan to watch, but it showed up sometimes.
Yeah, it is weird how both of those shows are Canadian and they both just like they were like fillers or something.
Yeah, they're like this week we'll throw on some Canadian stuff anyway.
Anyway, thank you, Amanda. That was a nice little trip down PBS memory lane.
Yeah, and I think you would really like the original Degrassi Junior High, Emily. So we should.
It is really good. Yeah. Cool. So the recap of this book.
I'm wondering, Emily, if you can list the micro mysteries if you created a catalog of them.
Okay, so one is Christy is reading an old book about Stony Brook history from Watson's library, and there's somebody named Christina with a C, Thomas, who mysteriously disappeared in 1863 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's sort of two mysteries there for Christy. One is, am I related to her?
Mm-hmm.
Two is, Where did she go? Then she starts investigating the mystery, and it turns out there may be treasure.
She so what was happened like, to her treasure?
What happened to her treasure? Then there's like mysterious things happening at the arboretum. So there's an arboretum that Jessie takes some babysitting charges to because she got put in charge of plant sitting and is killing the plants. So she's like, and everyone's bored. It's February. So they're like really scraping the bottom of the barrel for babysitting activities.
Yeah.
And then the woman who works there is like, oh, well, we might have to close it because some developers want to buy the land. So they're like fixing it up to make it more attractive to the potential rich like buyer who will be basically just a patron of it because the, I don't know, like the town subsidizes the arboretum, it sounds like, but the land is the land rights are up for grabs. The developer found out that it's not properly owned by the town. So it's going to go to auction or something.
Which is the other mystery is
where are the land rights?
And where was Christina's estate?
Oh, yeah. I don't know where she lived.
Squire Lot, which I kept reading as Squirrel Lot.
Squire Lot.
Same. Yeah. Is that Squirrel Lot?
Squire a lot. Okay, so then there's the mysterious things that keep happening while they're helping with the yard work. Cookie Mason starts acting weirdly. So that's another mystery.
Does Christina have any relatives in town? So Christy manages to look up her family tree and all this information and figures out that her like great niece, Mildred, grandniece Mildred
was still alive,
and in town. And finds her. So that's another mini mystery. You're right. I wasn't keeping track as we went, but it's a lot.
Yeah. And spoiler alert, they're all connected.
Yeah. Oh, and what does Christina's letter? So Mildred gives Christy a letter that Christina wrote to her, the man she was in love with, but her brother was trying to marry her off to his business associate.
Yeah.
And so she like fled and told him to meet at their special place. And Christy has a copy of the letter. But where's the special place? And what do the symbols on the letter mean? And what does the letter mean?
Yeah, it's a lot.
It's a lot.
And they solve them all.
Yeah. Well, I'm wondering if Ellen Miles got feedback after some other man is also staying in the house that the next mystery had to be a little more complex.
Yeah. That was
Scholastic was like, Miles, this one's a shit show. Can you give us actual mysteries, please? So she just packed him in.
Yeah, I wonder what this was inspired by. Like, Secret Garden.
There's some Secret Gardens Nancy, elements.
Nancy Drew meets, I don't know.
Yeah, Scooby there's Doo. Definitely...
meets Murder, She Wrote meets
I think you did
Matlock.
It
yeah, our bucket is missing. Isn't that mysterious? Someone's trying to sabotage.
I know, I was like, sabotage. The bucket's missing. Yeah. It's just not the bucket, there's more.
Yeah,
I know, but also like, who are the real estate developers is sort of a mystery. Like, are they related to the other mysteries?
Yeah, because at one point
it's a business card on the ground
and it's DT developers, and Christina's brother's name was Devin Thomas, and he had like a junior and a third, and so it could be the other half of the family trying to get
DT Trip lots. Was like, I know what I'm gonna do, I'm gonna name my kid DT the fourth. I hate rich people, I'm sorry.
That's just gonna be shocking. It's gonna be shocking to our listeners.
I know.
I apologize if you're a Trip, but I have judgments of your family. What?
Please, if you are a third, please write in and tell us about it and tell us how you feel about it. We'd love to know. I guess most of our listeners are female. That's
Stony Brook at unlikely.
Did you say a turd?
Wow. Wow.
Too easy.
Got me. It worked on me.
Oh, man. Yeah. All right. Well, Emily, you want to go first on this one, or you want me to go first on this
one? Wait, did we solve the mystery?
Oh, right. You know, go ahead. What happens, Anne?
So, I don't know. They are like, it's a full moon. We got to go to the arboretum when there's a full moon.
In her letter, there's rose vines and there's a perfect circle. So, and they notice.
Okay, but first, you skipped a really critical detail, which is that both Stacy and Christy find out on the same day, but through different means, that the arboretum is Squire
Squirrel
Lot.
Lot.
Yeah. Squirrel Lot. Squirrels a lot.
Yes. Yeah. They find a plaque. And also Christy is like, at the library lining up ancient maps with a modern day map of Stony Brook and figures it out. Yeah.
Yeah. A little Indiana Jones, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Good call. Yeah.
Wow, Anne. Wow.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay, so full moon, it like shines on, what does it shine on? Like,
well, first they think it's the Rose Garden, but they're not having much luck there. And Cokie says something about the roses being red on the letter. And because she had seen the original, because Mrs. Abbott is Cokie's grandma, that also gets revealed. I don't know if we said that.
Which is, come on.
Yeah. And then, because Cokie's there trying to solve the mystery at the same time, they run into Cokie. The night, the full moon night that they go to the Arboretum to solve the mystery.
Cokie overhears them talking about it and then gets territorial because she's like, that's my grandma. If anyone has a claim on this treasure by birth, it's me.
Sure. But she also meets them at the Arboretum, but thinks she's going to find the treasure first. And then they just kind of work together. Like with, they don't really.
Yeah. They're kind of bitchy to her though.
Yeah. I mean, that's how it goes. That's that's the one person they're allowed to be bitchy to in the whole universe. I'll give it to them. And then. Then Dawn realizes, no, the roses are brown and that there's all this intricate carved wood toward the front and there's rose bushes there. And then they dig at the base of that pole and they find a box that basically says, if you're finding this, I'm gone. And I took my fortune with me.
Which was her gold? What was it?
Yeah, it's just, we don't know what it physically was, I don't think. I think Christy was thinking it would be gold. And then we find out that her boyfriend was killed in the line of duty. And we don't know what really happened to Christina, if she survived.
Yeah, he was a Union soldier.
Yeah.
From Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
How did they meet?
I don't know.
That's another mystery.
Maybe they both came into New York City to have some fun.
Have some fun. Huh? Yeah.
Alert, alert.
You know, New York's between the two areas. Anyway. Yeah. So, but they find but what is there is the deed to Squirrel Lot. And so because they have the deed and the land rights had been up for debate, said, if I don't survive, then I bequeath Squirrel Lot to the city of Stony Brook. And so that saves the Arboretum because the city now owns it outright instead of just maintaining it and assuming they would take care of it. So the developers have to go away. And then Mrs. Vanderbellen, whoever the rich lady was that was going to buy it but didn't want to buy it because it was too ugly, because the girls messed it up. We mixed that part up. They messed it up digging for treasure. She comes when they fixed it all up nice for the like gala event. And then she decides to be a patron anyway. Mm-hmm. So she signs up for Patreon, Squirrel Lot's Patreon. There's bonus content.
Yeah. It's stuck in Stony Brook at patreon.com.
Yeah. I also realized I put this book in like a Harry Potter world also.
Wait, what?
I don't know. I'm picturing like some big grand house and like the spooky, like the Arboretum's like Hogwarts or something like that. And it's like,
did you just call it Hogwarts? Plural?
Yeah, multiple Hogwartses.
Squirrels lot.
Squirrels lot.
Squirrels a lot. I mean, that I get that the vibe of the library with like the old tomes is giving Hogwarts Library. Mm-hmm. I think that's canon.
Yeah, there were some Hogwarts touches in this for sure.
I think so. So the garden, we're saying is
the greenhouse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they can go to herbology class.
Yeah.
Wow, Anne. This is Goldstein or whatever her name was.
Yeah. Really onto something here.
Goldsmith. Yeah. Sorry, Goldsmith.
Yeah, Ellen Miles created Harry Potter is what you're onto.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
You should come here for the hard-hitting facts, Stony Brookers. Hard-hitting facts.
I mean, whatever. We don't owe anything to J.K. Rowling anymore. So.
No, we don't. I'm happy to promulgate this myth that it was all Ellen Miles and she languishes in obscurity here in New England writing her stories about dogs now while J.K. Rowling makes off with all the profits.
Should I go first?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. I have some nuggety things. So I just want to laugh really quickly at the beginning when Christy says that apparently one feature of Watson's personality is that he makes the worst jokes in the world, which is just like such a hot take. I love that. In chapter 2, Christy spends a lot of time not just on Claudia's outfit or Stacey's outfit, but on everyone's outfits, and justifies that by saying the way you dress, like reflecting on the fact that the way you dress says a lot about you, and several times that like different babysitters' appearance reflect their personality. Mm-hmm. I was struck by like how resonant this is with the theory of gender performance or performativity, which becomes like kind of a dominant frame in feminist theory and burgeoning queer theory for thinking about the relationship of sex to gender and for even like destabilizing the rigidity of the sex binary, right? So like, you know, you have Simone de Beauvoir, one is not born, but rather becomes a woman. So you are born into a sexed body, right? It is a male, female body, but you, the process of becoming a woman is the process of being socialized, right? And for Beauvoir, it's a kind of like existential phenomenological argument. Some people think about it as literally like gender kind of like congeals onto a sex body.
Ew. Congeal is just such an evocative verb. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
But then you have Butler in the late 80s and early 90s who offers like the performance as a kind of framework for thinking about gender. So she says things like, actually, I'll read a little passage from one of the early essays. So they argue, if the ground of gender identity is the stylized repetition of acts through time and not a seemingly seamless identity, then the possibilities of gender transformation are to be found in the arbitrary relation between such acts, in the possibility of a different sort of repeating, in the breaking or subversive repetition of that style, to show that what is called gender identity is a performative accomplishment compelled by social sanction and taboo. In its very character as performative resides the possibility of contesting its reified status. So it's about like, right, we have these norms and rules that structure the, mm-hmm. the gender binary, but we also know in a kind of mundane daily sense that like there are no perfect men and perfect women that are like perfect females and perfect males, right?
Right.
And we're always kind of like working with and against those rules and taboos. And they're actually, if we think about it, quite slippery. So like gender and our experience of ourselves as gendered entities is about the relationship between the sort of boring ways we comport ourselves every day, both consciously and unconsciously, and like the social norms and taboos, and like our bodies are the site of that kind of interaction. And I think like, you know, for Christy, it's like the way you dress, but it's not like one reading of that is that it's like a superficial way to think about meaningful kind of like differences in personalities between mm-hmm. and among the girls, right? Like, you know, preppy signify or like a preppy outfit signifies a certain type of girl, right? Mm-hmm. But I think the way that she treats it here is actually really thoughtful, and it's much more like Butler, right? Like these aren't hard, fast, like there's not like five options for how to be a girl mm-hmm. and each girl is one, right? It's like they all are navigating, right, different demands and requirements of girlhood. For Marianne, it's like her strict father who wants her to remain younger. For Stacy, it's like she had to grow up really fast, right? She has like a embodied, right, illness, right? She has diabetes. So, and like she had this sophisticated upbringing. She's had to navigate divorce and being a single, an only child. And so like, I think there's a like really thoughtful way that this description of their like outfits, right? Their style and who they are is like much more about the range of possibilities of like what it's like to be a girl than it is like, and it, I mean, obviously we're tracking tropes for a reason, like it can devolve into tropes, but I thought it was a nice way to cast it. And I wondered if theories, like feminist theories of sex and gender are like entering into girls publishing, mm-hmm. you know, because this is, what year was this book published?
95.
Right. So this is like, you know, 8 years after Butler starts writing about like gender performance.
Well, and I feel like as a lesbian Smith College graduate, Anna Martin's friends are sending around articles and talking 100%. About these things.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I don't think that this is out of Anna Martin's wheelhouse at all. Right. And I think even if she hadn't literally read Butler, I think her agenda of expanding the definition of girlhood and showing all the possibilities is clear from the beginning, right? And so it makes sense to me that that would be emphasized in this way. I think it's really interesting that Christy is, that like she sort of says in her description, like, I don't know anything about this stuff, so I'm just going to try to like, she doesn't say like an anthropologist, but she basically says, I'm going to try to describe it all for you because I don't really know what it means or what it signifies. And I thought it was interesting to have Christy be the one to do that, because so often we get editorializing from the other girls, right? Whether it's Mallory mm-hmm. saying how cool everybody is, or whether it's Marianne or Dawn being a little more on the judgmental side. And so it was interesting to take the person that kind of has the least stake in how her friends dress to describe it as thoroughly as possible. I thought that was an interesting choice.
Yeah, it's cute. Yeah, I mean, like appearance reflecting the personality is not quite like what gender performance is, but I do think it's like, I could see some little hints of that in there, and I thought it was
cute.
A lot of class talk in this book, like, but nothing that's not well-worn territory for us, but I'm just going to flag some funny things about it. First, like Anne's point that also pissed me off, like Chrissy's like, ooh, what if I found this treasure and I'm rich? Like, first of all, what are you talking about? What claim do you have on this treasure? I don't like, finders keepers is not a thing. What was the other? Oh, Dawn wants a private jet. When they're all fantasizing about what they would do with their winnings. And some of them have like really silly things, but, and like Dawn's motivation for the private jet is like sweet, right? It's like, oh, I could go back and forth between California and Connecticut anytime I want. So that solves my like family problem, right? Which is feeling pulled. And were you like, I also would like a private jet?
Me? No, it's just like, that's just ridiculous. If you're supposed to be like, Miss, it's bad. I know.
It just felt like so unrealistic that she would not make a comment about how bad a private, like, I know it's bad for the environment, but then I could see my dad and Jeff every time I want. Right. So funny. I thought the drama about the real estate developer was really funny. Like like in their imaginations of who's sabotaging them, there's like I imagine them as like real estate developers wearing like cartoon mustaches and carrying fake surveyor equipment, like sneaking around and spying on the girls, trying to like get, you know, like it, that part felt very Scooby-Doo campy to me. They're like imagining of these like nameless, faceless developers like spying on them and sabotaging their work.
For sure.
But it's interesting. There's nothing like really super specific about in the 90s about real estate development, which was a little surprising to me. I mean, like, obviously in the US, like commercial real estate or like large scale residential development actually like is basically just as old as like the Colonial Project, which is like not true in like Europe. Right. And so it's kind of like funny that in this moment there's like developers that are maybe big bad guys, you know.
Yeah, I was wondering about that too, but I do remember being in the 90s. I mean, this is 95, so I remember a lot of concerns, and Anne, I wonder if you feel like this too, of, you know, like big businesses taking over small things, right? Which is not the same as real estate development, but it's, you know, which culminates in like the plot of You've Got Mail, right? But that's not for a few years yet. But I remember being really concerned about that. Like, I remember when Jamba Juice came to Sacramento, we were worried about Green Planet Juicery, which was our like local smoothie place, closing because we didn't want Jamba Juice. We only wanted Green Planet. And like, this was like a topic of conversation. And so to me, it felt sort of a piece with that, of like the mollification of America and the sameness of America, and that they're going to get rid of this historic, unique place and put up some shitty apartments that they have in every town.
Right. And like, you know, it's probably not going to be affordable housing. Okay. So there's that whole thing, too. Mal has a button on her shirt when Christy's describing her that says, "I read banned books," which I thought was very cute. And like, interesting that that's sort of like in the middle school political zeitgeist in the 90s.
Yeah, it was big. And it makes me really sad every time they reference banned books in the Babysitter's Club, because we're in such a bad place still.
Yeah. And then my last little nugget is that this is the second time the New York Knicks get mentioned in the Babysitter's Club series, which I think is really funny. There's a lot of sports talk in this book. It's mostly baseball, but we learn that like Nanny is a big basketball fan and she's like a big fan of the Knicks, which I just thought was like very hilarious.
Yes, it was very hilarious. I was also surprised and pleased that Christy is a Mets fan.
Yes, I knew you would be.
I didn't think Connecticut would lean that way. You know, it seemed like she, you know, she's geographically directly between the Yankees, and I mean, obviously much closer to the Yankees, but between the Yankees and the Red Sox, and you could kind of go either direction. But the fact that she goes further south and is a Met fan made me pleased.
Yeah.
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 That's my East Coast team. Yeah. Oh, by the way, June wants you to take her to a Mets game when she visits.
You have mentioned that before.
Yeah. Okay. She's mentioned it to me multiple times. That's why.
This seems like a good way to use our podcast.
Yes. Oh, sorry. Just thought of it. Mets. We're talking about the Mets. There was one other thing that I thought that you would think was funny, which is how do they refer to Watson at the like event?
Oh, he's like a important, like capital I, important community member or something yes. like that. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Influential citizen. That's
oh,
what
yeah.
it is.
Influential citizen. Yeah. That's good.
I was like, oh, man, rich people.
Yeah. And yeah. this bitch is over here like, I need treasure so I can have wealth of my own. Get out of here, Christy. Yeah. All okay. Right. Those are my nuggets.
Great. Well, I had two different things. One, I tried to look into and I was not successful because my guess is that this literature lives in different databases than I search as a psychologist. So I have a question that I'm hoping, I don't know, do you guys think any librarians or school teachers listen to this podcast? I'm hoping that some of the librarians and school teachers that listen to this podcast might be able to answer. But this brought up to me this sort of idea of girl role models in history and literature. And I think both in a meta way, I think that Anna Martin is attempting to write the girls as role models and attempting to think about who their role models are. We've seen it before. And Mallory has talked about the books that she likes. And they all talk about the books that they like a great deal. Or when I guess it was Mallory who was into Harriet the Spy earlier, things like that. And then Christy, of course, feels this kinship for Christina Thomas because they have similar names. But the girls also all make a lot of comments like, you know, it was really hard to be a girl back then. And you didn't, you know, she was only 18 when she disappeared and women didn't get to make their own decisions and a teenage girl couldn't go places on her own. And I wouldn't stand for that. But she seems like she was a pretty special person. You know, they make those kinds of comments. And I was curious about, I think that intention is often there in the way we tell history, in like our former guest, Kate Schatz, writing all those books about rad American women and rad women worldwide to inspire young girls. And I think that that's often the intent with fiction as well. But I was just wondering if there's any data on that, like if we know if that actually has an impact on girls' self-image or self-efficacy. You know, it's clear that the BSC really feel a kinship with Christina and feel empathy for her plight, that her mm-hmm. brother's trying to marry her off to his business partner and she doesn't, you know, the love of her life is off fighting on the good side in the Civil War. And they're sort of carried off by the romance of it, but especially by her independence. It's not just mm-hmm. the romance story that they get into, but it's also her independence. So I was just curious about that. Like it has a lot of face validity, right? It certainly seems true that those stories would be inspirational and would be helpful going forward. And I certainly felt like that as a kid, but I was just wondering if anybody's ever actually studied it. Like yeah, what effect does that have? Like our models in history and in literature, what effect does that have on self-efficacy, on goals, on the way you view the role of women and girls in the world, any of those kinds of things. But I couldn't find it in the psychology literature. Yeah. Do you have a grant or do you have a fortune that you have found recently that could pay for it?
You're the Christie among us. Get to digging.
Yeah. And you have something in your mattress. Do you want to be my patron?
No, my mattress is spoken for.
Anne's the rich benefactor who walks in and says, oh, there's a hole in this ground. I am not purchasing this land.
Yes, she is.
Gets these vines off the ground.
That's exactly
there are
right.
Too many children here.
That's exactly right, Mrs. Vanderbellen Kawa. Yeah. So anyway, librarians, English teachers, hit us up. Let us know. stuckinstonybrook@gmail.com. I'm really curious. And then the other thing I talked about, Anne and I recently did a little interview for a newspaper column about nostalgia and the influence of nostalgia. And I thought the idea of historical nostalgia was pretty present in this book. So there's two types of nostalgia. There's personal nostalgia, like Anne and I were just engaging in at the top of the episode, thinking about when we would catch Degrassi Junior High on PBS on a lucky afternoon and feel excited about it, right? That's nostalgia for things that you actually experienced in a time in your own past. And then there's historical nostalgia, which people can feel for times that they didn't actually live through, but that feel meaningful or that they feel connected to. So we see mm-hmm. the girls engaging in this with Christina's story. And I was interested, I had looked up a lot more about personal nostalgia for this interview that we did. And I was much more interested in what do we know about historical nostalgia and how does it function? And it will surprise, I think, you both, not at all, that it's a fairly toxic impulse. So we may be recording this on the eve of an important United States election that is predicated on the idea of going back to better times versus not. And there's actually some data on this, that when people are more obsessed with historical nostalgia, there are increases in nationalism and xenophobia. So there was a study by Elgenius and Rydgren in 2022 called Nationalism and the Politics of Nostalgia that showed that people that were higher on historical nostalgia were more likely to have racist right-wing beliefs. Yes. Turns out historical nostalgia, not something that a lot of people of color feel around the world, shockingly. But what was really interesting to me is there was a study that just came out this year. I'm not sure how to pronounce the lead author's name. It looks like Lognane to me, L-O-U-G-H-N-A-N-E, that the title of which is Collective UK Nostalgia Promotes Brexit. And they found that people who had a bigger sense of connection and wistfulness toward the monarchy and times past and the history of England were much
British
more
imperialism.
Likely. Yeah. Who had glowing thoughts about British imperialism, wanted to and did vote for Brexit and wanted to sever ties with the European Union. And people that did not engage highly in historical nostalgia did not want to. And that it often obscures judgment and obscures facts in the current moment. Mm-hmm. Just thought that was interesting. I don't think the girls are engaging in it too much. They're more inspired by Christina. They're not saying, oh, it was better in the Civil War when women didn't have rights. But it did lead me to think about that because of how much they were romanticizing the connection she had with her boyfriend and the estate itself. The fact that this was a time when people had estates with names and
I was actually thinking like when you posited the question of whether it would be like developmentally meaningful for girls that like in like feminist historiography, we talk a lot about like recovering a history of women like acting politically, because if you have like a one-off, right, like Mary Wollstonecraft was the only woman who was thinking about women's rights in the entirety of like English, you know, philosophical history, is just like not true. She's the only one who's like writing Got Saved. You know what I mean? So like there's almost a kind of inverse problem that is subtle and like unspoken when you pick out one exemplar who wrote against the times, then it makes it seem like every other girl or woman of the time was sort of like either like suffering in silence out of false consciousness or just like willingly submitting to their roles. Like it's probably true that a lot of her friends and peers did a lot of things acting out against their prescribed social roles, right? So like what is there like a danger in the kind of exemplar hero that like takes away from the presence of actual real dissent like over time and in different ways? So that was sort of what I was thinking when you raised that question.
Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah. Which doesn't mean we shouldn't tell their stories, because it's still better than it just being a bunch of white men.
Right. But like, how do we tell them?
Yeah. That's interesting. Anne, you've been quiet. Is this just a long day for you, or Emily and I being too academic?
Too smart.
All right. As per usual, you know your role. Save us.
Yeah. Okay. So there are some nuggets, but nothing that interesting. Like once I dug into it, I was like, oh, there's no like interesting story here. But you know, I think this is the first time where Barney is brought up, because like Watson is like, yeah, Michelle, we can watch Barney when we go home, you know. And she was like, Barney, I'm gonna watch Barney. So obviously I did not watch Barney. I was too old for Barney. Emily also too old. Did you watch
it? We watched it.
You watched it. Okay. Emily's the right age. It's like, okay, so first,
I mean, we weren't obsessed, but we definitely watched it.
Right.
Like we knew that we'd sing the songs, you know, the clean up your room song or whatever.
How does it go?
How's the Clean Up Your Urine song go?
I don't know. Clean up, everybody, everywhere. Clean up, everybody, do your share. I think is like the
nice.
Yeah.
Okay. Boring. That song. Okay.
It's not a good song.
None of the songs are good on that show.
It's the job done.
Yeah. So I was like reading about Barney, blah, blah, blah. And okay, apparently there was a Barney movie in the works. Like this is a recent article, but it's not a kids movie. It's a movie that's going to be for adult millennials who grew up watching Barney.
Absolutely not. I do not want that.
Fuck up.
Right. So this is
toxic nostalgia. This is personal nostalgia gone terribly wrong.
So this is a quote from some article, I think from like a movie website, but this is from the Mattel Films executive, Kevin McKeon. He told the New Yorker this. We're leaning into the millennial angst of the property rather than fine-tuning this for kids. It's really a play for adults. Not that it's R-rated, but it'll focus on some of the trials and tribulations of being 30-something, growing up with Barney, just the level of disenchantment within the generation. Both of you just started shaking your heads.
But I mean, like, I'll let you speak for millennials, Emily. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, but I don't speak for millennials. I think that that's ridiculous that one person could speak for an entire generation.
I just meant among the three of us, dummy. Christ on a bike. Anne and I speak for all of Gen X, unlike you.
You do, okay? And you claim to often.
Well, as the only person who watched Barney as a kid.
I mean, I would not watch that.
Yeah. But they want to, A24. They want it to be like one of those films, like.
But to my mind, that just feels like a desperate ploy to work off of the success of Barbie, right?
Definitely. I think it. But is I feel like
what was interesting about Barbie is that Greta Gerwig did it,
right?
And there's there are social politics at stake in telling Barbie's story. Like, I don't know what's at stake with Barney.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't understand how that could be made into a two-hour movie.
I would not watch that.
No.
That's really interesting, though, because I also remember I feel like I had a newspaper article on my wall about hating Barney. Like, I remember
this is the next thing I'm going to talk about.
Oh, okay. Oh, great. Good. The backlash, the Barney hatred. The
backlash.
I was very strong in it.
There's an anti-Barney humor Wikipedia page because there's so much.
Oh, my gosh.
It was such a thing. And it's pretty interesting, just like, because like parents didn't like the show, or like a lot of parents didn't like the show because it was just like really boring. And like, you know, Sesame Street, you could watch with your kids. Like it was kind of, adults could watch it, but Barney was just really, people complained about it being saccharine, boring, annoying, uneducational, sugary. But what's interesting is there is this website, which is among the oldest websites in the world, that was created in 1994, which is called the Barney Fun Page. And it's this really an outline drawing of Barney, and you can like pick a knife, gun, axe, Uzi, shotgun, motorcycle, or cannon. And it's like, you can just like put these things on him, but it doesn't look like a gun is just like a circle. You put like a little
circle. Right. It's like made in MS Paint or whatever.
And then it's like Barney has been slightly wounded. And then it's like Barney's starting to feel less than healthy. And then it's like Barney's condition is rapidly deteriorating. And then
it's like a Tamagotchi. Like,
yeah, it's like Barney could use some medical attention then until finally you like kill him. But wow. I thought it was funny that it's like still one of the oldest running websites in the world.
That is funny.
Yeah. So, and then this kind of veers into your territory, Esme, but I've found some articles about Barney playing a part in the stereotype that millennials are like entitled.
Mm.
Like it helped raise this generation of like entitlement.
Mm.
And there's this article called The Bad News About Barney that was published in Parents Magazine in 94 by Shava Willig-Levy. And it's a long article, but this is probably the most, her thesis statement here. In a word, denial, the refusal to recognize the existence of unpleasant realities, where along with his steady diet of giggles and an unconditional love, Barney offers our children a one-dimensional world where everyone must be happy and everything must be resolved right away. And then she gives examples of that. So as an example, it's like, Sean looks at his easel in dismay and says, I'm not a very good painter. Lisa replies, oh, I wouldn't say that, Sean. Barney says, Lucy's right, Sean. Your painting of me is terrific. You're a wonderful artist. But it's just like a lot of examples of like, it's like, I'm having a bad day. And then Barney be like, that's okay. All you have to do is smile. And it's like a lot of like that. There's like no problem solving or actually talking about your emotions. Mm-hmm. It's just like, let's just cover it up. Like, you know, you're great. Like, it's fine.
Toxic positivity.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's toxic positivity.
I don't know how that leads to entitlement. I can see how that leads to anxiety and challenges with emotions. Mm-hmm. But that's an interesting thesis. But that was, I mean, I tried watching it a bunch of times when we were teenagers because I babysat a lot, not just for Emily, but for a lot of kids in the neighborhood. And I was like, this is fucking garbage. Like, why would you watch this when you could watch Sesame Street? And I saw somewhere like a thing about about this same issue, not toxic, it wasn't labeled toxic positivity, but this idea that like just Barney also does everything right. Like, if you think about all the Muppets, they're all like flawed.
Right.
You know, like Muppets make mistakes and do things dumbly and then, you know, like kids do. But Barney would just like tell you how to do things right. Like, everybody do your share. Like, what if you don't feel like cleaning up today? You know, so I found it very frustrating when I would watch it with the kids I was babysitting for.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think
we watch anything else.
Yeah, you can't blame a TV show for that. But it is interesting that it was so popular, yet so many people hated it. Mm-hmm. Like, kids seem to love it. Adults seem to hate it.
Yeah.
So, and then that's interesting because it's like, I read an article where it was like, the like producers were like, well, it's a show for kids. It's not for the parents, right?
Right.
So the kids like it. And I was like, well, that's true. Like,
yeah, but it's not a long-term marketing strategy. Like, that's why things like Sesame Street are better. Yeah. Better in Mr. Rogers, like adults like those things and will watch them with their kids.
Louis?
Yeah, amazing.
Louis's great.
top tier children's show. Yes.
Yeah. But yeah, so I mean, it went on for like, I don't know, like, geez, 14 seasons or something.
Wow.
Yeah, it like lasted like a really long time.
Yeah, that is a really long time.
Oh yeah, Barney. But yes. My experience and my memory of Barney is just like all the anti-Barney stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like that was just in pop culture where it's like you just see someone like beating a fake Barney with like a baseball bat. Or...
It was in like late night monologue jokes.
No,
like,
totally.
Letterman would talk about Barney. So weird. The 90s were a time.
I mean, it's still very wholesome compared to now. It's like, we're going to make fun of a fictional giant dinosaur.
Right.
You know. Anyway. That's what I've got. And besides that, Fig Newtons are named after the town Newton in
Massachusetts.
Yep.
Oh, wow.
Oh.
Yeah. I have a bunch of friends from there. That's also where Boston College is.
Yeah. I guess when Nabisco, or what became Nabisco, started to make their products, they just started to name them after towns around Boston.
Wow. That's a really fun fact. I'm going to go share that with all the people I know from Newton.
Wait, what other products are named for towns around Boston?
I mean, those don't exist anymore.
So like, I didn't want a follow-up question.
Yeah. But also, Fig Newtons are not called Fig Newtons anymore. They're just called Newtons. They're just called Newtons.
Because fig people don't like figs?
People don't like figs.
But you know what was in this? They don't have them anymore, do they? Apple Newtons and Cherry Newtons? I remember when those came out in the 90s. It was exciting. I was happy to see them.
Apple Newtons were good because they were kind of like apple pie.
Yeah, they were all good. I loved all the fruit Newtons.
Yeah, I like Newtons too. They're like a little cake.
The fruit Newtons.
Yeah, they're Newtons are not cookies. They are fruit and cake. That was that advertisement.
Yeah. I'll still eat, like, I'll still get those, like, four packs of Newtons, you know?
I haven't bought Newtons in forever. I'm going to add them to my grocery list. I should have gotten some today. It'll make me really happy.
I bought some healthy ones.
Like, oh, no, don't do that. No, fuck that noise.
I know.
Aren't those just like granola bars?
Exactly.
Healthy Fig Newtons.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's like organic fruit made with organic fruit and like whatever. I don't
know. Yep.
Okay. I get behind it.
So a candy was introduced called Coco Blinkins, which is not a real thing. Yeah.
I was like, what the fuck?
Why? Why are they making up a candy like 100 books in?
Coco Blinkins? Also, what's a Blinkin?
I have no idea. You couldn't find anything?
No.
It's not like a regionalism? Listeners, does anybody know what a Coco Blinken is supposed to be?
Yeah. All right. She said, but I think she said, has anyone tried them yet? They're terrific. So it sounds like she's like, this is like a new candy I found. Coco Blinken.
It's a terrible name.
Terrible. Then I think there are some popcorn and M&Ms.
And all the Newtons.
And all the Newtons. Yeah. Big Apple cherry.
Steakout food.
Chips Ahoy. Yep. And grapes and sourdough pretzels.
Were sourdough pretzels.
Yeah, do you think they were Snyder's of Hanover?
I hope so.
Yeah.
But they were pretzel Blinkens.
I mean, that sounds better than Coco Blinken.
It's true.
I still don't know what a Blinken is, but
I would eat a pretzel Blinken though. I would try it.
So
the only tally I caught was almond shaped eyes. It returns.
Yeah.
There might have been others and I just got distracted because I thought this book was pretty well written and interesting, but that was the one that I caught.
Yeah. Same.
Okay.
Okay.
What do we have for weirdest line?
Well, I feel like an obvious contender is Squirrel Lot. Just like
squirrely lot.
Ridiculous amount of times I have to say that. I really liked Christy saying this is a stakeout, not a fashion show, which was just like so rude.
That's very good. That's a very good Babysitter's Club line.
No reason. When Christy is visiting the old Abbott lady, Cookie Mason's grandmother, the first time, I forget the context. She has to like go outside and grab something and come back in. And she tells her, go on, girl. I just think is like so absurd. It's like, I think that's Ellen Miles trying to like be like, what would an old aristocratic lady say to like a young girl who she's not related to? And I just don't think that's true. I don't think she would have said that.
Isn't there a bit of like Hayley Mills, Pollyanna in this too?
Yeah, I see that. Yeah.
And then the last one is not really that funny, but it made me laugh in the moment when Buddy Barrett. Oh, what is this context? It's like when they're at the Arboretum and he's like bragging or like showing off what he's learned. And he says, I know how to do lots of stuff now. Just like a one-off sentence, which I thought was like just a funny thing for a kid to say.
I think that's really good too. The only one I wrote down was when they're thinking about how rich Christie's going to be. And Stacy drops some designer names to her as if Christy would care about that. And Christy says, I had no idea who Gautier was. And she spelled it GOAT/EE/A. I thought that was funny. It's a little bit of a Philip Mignon moment.
I'm going to go with Coco Blinkens.
All right. My vote is for this is a stakeout, not a fashion show. Because I think it's funny.
That's probably
it's good for the book. But I do like Coco Blinken, so if Emily wants to go for that one, it's fine with me.
No, I think we should do the one that's more relevant to the book, which is Coco
Blinken. That's an unusual choice for us. Never mind, you bait the tree there.
Good one.
I mean, look, Anne, if you want to win, I'll give you Coco Blinken.
Like, can we pizza toast to Coco Blinken?
Yes! Yes. Great. Okay, wait. I think we should each say what we think they are.
Okay.
I think it's like little chocolate droplets on paper, like candy buttons, but they're chocolate. I'm not saying they would be good.
Messy?
Yes.
It would melt.
Not if they have enough stabilizer in them.
Yeah.
That's my guess.
I think it's like a cereal puff wrapped in chocolate.
Okay.
Oh, okay. That's good. Like a Whopper, but with a cereal ball in the middle.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. I think, so it's interesting. They say cocoa instead of chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So maybe it's like something dusted in cocoa powder.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it is. How long you guys got? I got to think about it. Let's see. Coco Blinkens. Blink, blink. Okay, I'm gonna say it's like shreds of coconut. Like dipped in chocolate and dusted with cocoa powder.
Okay,
well,
what should we? Oh, we're pizza toasting to Coco Blinkens. Okay, to Coco Blinkens.
To Coco Blinkens.
This episode of Stuck in Stony Brook is now adjourned.
Thank you to Anna and Martin for everything. Stuck in Stony Brook is edited by Emily Crandall. Theme song written and recorded by Gary Schaller, performed by the band Kid Kit. You can follow us on Instagram at Stuck in Stony Brook or find us on our website, stuckinstonybrook.com. Need some books that we mentioned? Buy them from our bookshop and support both a local independent bookstore and your favorite series literature analysis podcast. Find us at bookshop.org/shop/stuckinstonybrook. Lastly, if you're feeling dibbly generous and you want to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, that would be super helpful. You're the best friends a girl could ask for.